My name is Max.
Hello, and welcome to the Divined Comedy, the only Dante podcast you will ever need, ostensibly. My name is Travis Sintel.
My name is Yuri Lowenthal, and you are awaited.
Oh,
see, crossover episode!
Crossover!
We did it,
killer
guys.
Crossover. All right. I'm nervous up in this bitch.
Who are you guys? Tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm Paul Cantrell.
I'm David Fountain.
Thank you, Paul and David.
Cut.
So here's, let's just launch into it. We can just do this for the whole thing. Listeners of both podcasts, here's what happened here. Two of my good friends from college, David Fountain and Paul Cantrell, have a podcast called The Divined Comedy, where they go canto by canto in Dante's Divine Comedy week by week. Similarly to how we do with Mad Max, 4 minutes at a time, and we thought, after much conversation amongst Paul and I, that there are a lot of interesting intellectual crossovers and storytelling devices to be discussed betwixt Dante and George Miller. And we thought, time for a crossover episode.
Crossover.
Doing it.
Crossover.
This is like, you say crossover episode, I'm immediately thinking like a Homicide: Life on the Street.
You just won my
CSI.
Heart by saying Homicide: Life on the Street. I just want you to know that anything that happens for the rest of this podcast, anything could happen, and I'll still marry you.
Oh, man, thank you.
I'm Richard Munch in this? Is that
you're
Belzer. So you're Belzer. The Munch in this, and you're Richard Belzer.
I'm Clark Johnson. I direct a little bit.
Right. So this will be a special victims unit or Law and Order,
exactly.
Or something or other. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be Law and Order, Homicide: Life on the Street crossover. That was every Friday night when I was in high school, going to parties. I grew up in Baltimore, and that was like my show.
Do you remember?
Yeah,
when,
of course it was.
Do you remember when like Urkel would show up on like Perfect Strangers and teach them how to dance?
There we go. That's
okay,
the crossover
okay,
I'm talking about.
Okay, remember
that was in the same universe because Harry Winslow was the elevator operator from the Bugle
Chicago
or whatever it was,
Tribune,
where Larry and Balky were.
Wait, this is a good time to mention that what the Divined Comedy really is about is dated 90s references, TV and film-wise. We've really segued nicely into what the real...
Let me just say, all the goodwill you earned with Homicide: Life on the Street, he just destroyed by bringing up Urkel in the same...
Squandered.
Wow.
Nailed it.
Squandered.
I am killing it right now.
This is the frickin' frack element of what we do. Do you want me to say what we do as far as what the... I mean, you said with the podcast...
Please, say what you do.
Ostensibly
give us the jam.
For those of you dear listeners unfamiliar with the Divine Comedy, it's a 13th century, or I guess 14th century Italian poem. Dante Alighieri wrote it. The premise is that he's in love with this woman, but she marries somebody else. He has to marry somebody else for political reasons. She dies young, and then his life is just kind of a hot mess. He's politically active, but gets exiled. And in the middle of all this, he creates a situation where this woman is in heaven. She sends for Virgil, his hero, guy who wrote the Aeneid, Virgil, big poet, sends for him in hell. Virgil has to go find Dante in the dark wood where the poem starts out. And Virgil has to basically go through hell and Purgatorio, Mount Purgatory, with Dante to get him to Beatrice. It's kind of a summons that he creates for himself.
Does he
turn around and
go back to where he started?
Virgil does.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a... That's like the big difference, I think, between Mad Max and... This is like really like the big difference.
If there's one difference, yeah.
No, he goes on through.
Dante goes on through. Virgil gets like most of the way up Mount Purgatory, and then spoiler, he's not allowed to go any further. He has to go back down to hell. So we're going to talk about that. This is actually the jump off for... I was listening to your podcast pretty extensively and thinking about it in terms of Dante, and it was actually the jump-off point for our podcast because I thought, wow, there are a lot of parallels here. What if we just did a podcast exclusively on Dante? And I texted Dave like the same afternoon. So you guys actually kind of inspired us to do what we do. So thank you.
Wow.
That's very nice to hear.
You know, I just realized that whereas I thought that I was pretty familiar with Dante's Inferno, what I realized as you're talking is I never have read all of the Divine Comedy, but I have read Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle's book Inferno, which is based on Dante's Inferno.
Oh, really?
But it's more of a sort of a sci-fi fantasy take on that. I mean, it's a retelling, but in
there's a video game too, and it's insane. It's like he's fresh off the Crusades. He's buff. He's like a knight, and he has to go find Beatrice and rescue her in hell, which is completely inaccurate. But the animation is badass. There's a video on YouTube about it.
Really? Okay, I'll have to. Yeah, you look up the book. I'll look up the video game.
All right,
the book
good.
I remember reading many times when I was younger.
And I read Dan Brown's Inferno based on Dante's Inferno, which is
we're
a
going to watch
King adventure story.
That movie comes out the day that we finish Inferno.
Oh, is that true?
Really?
Yeah, we got to go watch it. It comes out October 28th, I think.
That's
a big
really
misnomer
smart.
About the book is that people think Divine Comedy, and it's like, they're like, wait, what are you talking about? I think a lot of people think that it's just Inferno, and it really has to be taken in all three parts, because the whole point is that you have to go to hell to get to heaven, and it ends in heaven, and it's beautiful.
Right.
Oh, well, that's a good jumping off point for a conversation about Mad Max.
About Mad Max. Let's
get into it.
Let's do that.
Do you want to use that as our first jump off? I mean, I think that in theory, the way this podcast for both of us should go is trying to find points of commonality and teasing them out. And I think Paul's probably the best prepared to lead that conversation. But in terms of the idea, the basic idea of you have to go through hell to get to heaven, I mean, that feels like an obvious place to start.
Without a doubt.
And yeah,
in this case, is Max Virgil or is Furiosa Virgil?
Oh, this is
or neither of them.
This is going to be ridiculously funny.
I think.
I just want to jump in real quick and and explain that I don't really like the Divine Comedy.
So we really don't like Mad Max Fury Road either.
Well, you probably hate it now. But I mean, like, I really like Mad Max. I thought it was awesome. And I'm way more stoked to talk about something that's happened in the past year than this, I would be really glad if the effect of this podcast, of Paul and I's podcast, is that no one ever read this book again.
I feel so. Like I want to now spend more time talking about your relationship as podcast host than I did before.
Because this is going to be for David, this is a great reprieve where he gets to podcast about something for an hour or so that he actually gives a shit about.
Yeah.
Because the setup that we do, you mentioned, I mean, you guys do 4 minutes of Mad Max Fury Road at a time. We do a canto at a time. I guess one difference is that, like, you've already seen Fury Road several times in its entirety, whereas I read this whole thing a long time ago. Dave has never read past Inferno, so we don't have a whole work. We haven't already experienced the entire thing. So like we're kind of experiencing it in a chronological way, in a gradual way.
Right.
Well, let me speak to that. Actually, I think it's really interesting because although we have been able to grasp the work in its entirety, having seen it
right.
a couple times, so Yuri more so than myself. But there is, I would say we stick really hard to the idea of not reaching past the 4 minutes that we're in. I think we've
done
a really
good job. Yeah, no, I think you guys are great about it. Yeah.
Of just holding on to that, because there's something about sequentially building an argument over time and not reaching outside of that argument to the larger thing until the end. So, I think that we try to approach it similarly.
Oh, no, that wasn't a criticism at all. No, it's just an observation. Okay. I mean, I've read it before, and it's kind of, the whole thing is kind of filtered through my memory of, 10 years ago and then 18 years ago, one of the two other times I read it. But I will occasionally hint to David, say like, okay, so this thing's happening now. Heads up, in 5 cantos, we're going to have to come back to this moment because this other thing's going to happen. But I try to be, that's about as specific as I get normally,
Well, for the listeners, and when I say for the listeners, I mean for me, how long is it? I know how long 4 minutes is. How long is a canto?
A canto is usually about 120 lines or so.
It takes about 4 minutes to read one.
Yeah, that's
wow. There you go.
Well, David, it's funny because I prep, the night before, if not several nights in advance. I'm doing research and all this, and I show up to do the episode, and Dave's like, "Hang on, I need to read it real quick."
Right.
And then he'll just plow through it. You're like, "Okay, yeah, good to go. I've got like pages and pages of
David,
notes."
So David, you're the Travis of that podcast, and Paul, you're the Yuri of that podcast.
Right.
I mean, as far as the dynamic we have, it's basically like it's like what you guys do in terms of we try to pay attention to it when we need to, but. But there's also kind of like, I guess, like an analyzed fish thing where like there's a good cop, bad cop thing where I'm trying desperately to get David into this book. And the whole shtick is that he just doesn't want to read the book.
It's right, not really a shtick.
That was like Travis not reading the comic, the Mad Max comic forever.
Yeah. But, and you can't tell him to do anything.
You can't tell these guys. They're intractable.
He's an outdoor cat.
The difference is that I really like Mad Max Fury Road, and that seems to be a very key. Let's not glaze over that difference
sure.
It must be hard to do 300 episodes of a podcast where you don't like the material, Dave.
That's really hard.
it's 100 cantos long, so we're locked in for 100 episodes.
I might have made there might have been an error in judgment on my part when I agreed to do it.
And the, like, part everybody's heard of is the first third of it. So, like, by the time we get to Purgatorio, it's going to be like, we're just in no man's land, you know? But right, we should literally go on record. Like, sometimes you have people on the show that don't like Mad Max. Sometimes you have people that do like Mad Max. I love Mad Max Fury Road. David, you're...
I think it's amazing.
So we can just fan out for the whole thing.
I totally love it.
Yeah, I love... I started rewatching it last night. I watched it, I can't even tell you how many times.
I've only seen, yeah, it. I've seen it twice.
I love that we won't have to fight about that then.
Yeah, that's good.
Dave and I on their podcast thought about Force Awakens a lot. We don't have to relitigate, but right, just so you know, you're okay, Yuri's used to my relentless diatribes about
stuff. Yeah, no, yelling matches are totally welcome.
Well, in this one, we're all fanning about the same stuff. So
that's true. That is true.
Well, Paul, do you have any locked and loaded conversation kickoffs?
I will tell you the thing that that sparked all of this for me was. And I wrote all this out in a kind of prosaic way that I don't really need to get into, because I think I was going to send it to you just to see if there was anything to it, and then mm-hmm. you said, oh, you should just come on the show, whatever. This was like early June, I think. This was a while ago. But the idea is that we need to talk about who's Dante and who's Virgil in Mad Max Fury Road, but we also need to talk about Lucifer a little bit, because I need to give a little bit of background here, so just bear with me. I'll try to be brief. The idea of how hell got created, and I'm repeating myself, so David's just got to kind of bear me out here, but the idea is that, so before the world even exists, there's a war in heaven. Lucifer, God's brightest angel, decides that he gets hubristic, and he convinces the angels to go to war against God. He gets about a third of them on his side. He kind of dupes them into his service. Doesn't work out at all. God doesn't even get his hands dirty. He gets Archangel Michael, and I think Gabriel is in the mix. He's like commander-in-chief. They squash the rebellion. A third of the angels get kicked out of heaven. I think in Hebrew it's the same word as star. I think Borges says that. It's like a third of the stars fall from the sky. Milton says they fall for 9 days. So they're building up severe, like, terminal velocity. And as Lucifer approaches Earth, and Dante, this is confusing. And Dante says that all the land in the southern hemisphere was so afraid of him that it fled to the northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere became all water. Lucifer hits the earth, but he's going so fast he burrows into the earth and creates hell. And he's trapped in the bottom in ice. Whoa. And he's become a reptile at this point. His wings have turned into, like, dragon wings. Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, that got weird at the end. But I was really totally reptile part.
I was totally with you. And then, you know, when all the land moved to the other hemisphere. And then,
yeah, that's weird.
And then Satan turns into a reptile.
Yeah. By the way, so the whole point...
That's like Australia, basically.
Yeah, essentially.
So we're already building comparisons.
Good.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Good.
So, quick wrap up. So in Fallen, he creates hell, and he creates the means of punishment. He creates hell by burrowing into it, and it's this conic-shaped thing. But in doing so, the earth that he displaces it creates Mount Purgatory. So it also creates the means of purgation of the seven deadly sins to get to heaven. So if you die and you're a repentant sinner, you wake up on Mount Purgatory and you get to work purging your sins. When you get to the top of Mount Purgatory, this is where it gets interesting. At the very top of Mount Purgatory, it's the Garden of Eden. So the idea is that the earth he displaced, Eden got pushed all the way up to the top of this mountain. So the sense is that once you purge all of your sins, you're back where you started, free from original sin from Genesis.
I mean, for the listeners, this all feels very obvious, but let's just put it out there for everybody. This feels even more so than I expected, a very, very direct wrap-up of the plot of Mad Max. And I do think that we've been wrestling around this, Paul and Dave, watching Furiosa's transition and Max's transition. It does very much feel like a purging of sin and a purging of experience to get to somewhere pure. She feels like she has to redeem herself and apologize for what she's done.
She explicitly says redemption, yes.
Yeah, she's working for redemption in the course of this journey. She's going somewhere. She's going to the green place to find redemption. And when she gets there, it's not there. And realizes
it's in fact on top of a mountain.
Yeah, literally, it's
exactly.
Back on top of the mountain.
And that was the thing that I noticed. I think, I mean, pretty early, before the title sequence even when he's trying to escape being branded in the very beginning, and he runs out, and all of a sudden, I actually paused it last night and took a picture of it, because you only see it for a second, but he sees this verdant, like, green thing on top of this mountain, and I think there are, like, windmills on it or something. I couldn't really get a good enough look, and you only see it for a second, but, yeah, the idea that it's this elevated green space, and that mm-hmm. she is trying to get to... I don't know, we need to talk about it as well, because hell and purgatory are kind of necessarily vertical things, and whereas Furiosa's journey is primarily lateral. And I don't want—I don't want to hog the mic either. That's kind of like the basic setup.
I like it, and what that spurs for me is, you know, there's some. I think we're not best served probably by literal connections amongst the storytelling. Although the more we talk about it, the more I suggest in my head that maybe George Miller had thought through some of these things. But what I'm specifically interested in is that one of the reasons that I think Dante's writing remains effective is that it taps into this sort of Joseph Campbell-y mythic storytelling structure.
Yeah, sure.
And that what we've discovered from watching Mad Max is that there aren't always clear answers to what things mean, but they always tap into mythic veins of storytelling. And they allow you to feel in your gut sometimes a sort of deep emotional resonance just through tapping into the right symbols and the right storytelling beats. So that I think is an interesting sort of conversational line to go down, because I think they traffic in the same basic human storytelling needs, which oddly a lot of films don't do as much as they try to do in the 70s and 80s, I feel.
Right, yeah.
In the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, it's a part of storytelling in general.
Can you guys hear us?
Are you guys...
Hang on one second. We might need to...
Oh, no, it's fine. I was just...
David had to take his headphones off for just a second. He's just doing something, but I can still hear you guys. And David has actually probably more. This will transition nicely, because I said I don't want to talk the whole time just because I'm the guy who's read the whole book. But David's actually much better equipped to talk about Joseph Campbell and that hero's journey than I am, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, we talked about how the Divine Comedy it's a kind of a commonplace or topos or whatever of this epic literature where it starts in medias res. It starts with the hero at a low point, but. And Dante in the Dark Wood, I mean, he's basically suicidal at this point.
Yeah.
And then you eventually meet, when you go into hell, you meet the Wood of Suicides, where the people turn into trees, which is crazy. But to say that he starts at the lowest point at the beginning of the book is kind of a misnomer, because he thinks it's as bad as it gets, and then he goes all the way down hell.
So, yeah, like, bottoms out.
He definitely does kind of a Empire Strikes Back moment, where, like, it starts with the hero, and then you have to do the hero's descent into darkness or into some kind of despair.
Well, that's Mad Max to a T. He starts at a low point where he has nothing. He's eating lizards, and you think it's really shitty. And then he immediately gets captured, has his head shaved, gets beat up, has to escape, doesn't escape. You know what I mean? And then he's strapped to the front of a car and gets his blood drained from him. So it's the same structure for our hero's descent. It starts at a low point and then goes immediately into hell, to a lowest point someone could imagine, really, which is being strapped to the front of a moving car, having your blood drained from you into an asshole.
And there's some logistical things that I want to ask you guys about. One thing that I really like about your guys' podcast is that the fact that you will lean into these ideas so hard and see if they push back, see if there's resistance there, and it seems to me that every idea you've covered that you've thought through, you realize, God, Miller thought of this. He had a conversation, whether it was in his own head or with somebody else. Everything is, it's a fully realized world you're in, and I love the fact that you guys push on those things just to see what happens.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, even if, you know, we could say, yeah, he was thinking of Dante's Inferno at some point or other, or not. The journey that he puts the characters through is through different levels of something. It wouldn't be, you know, exactly nine levels of hell or whatever.
Yeah.
But it does, you know, track in some ways. First, they break from the road, and then they have to go through the storm. Oh wait, is the storm
fight.
The first?
There's a little fight they have there.
Well, because the what do you call it? The spiky cars. Well, why am I thinking? Yeah. You know, first it's them.
The buzzards. Yeah.
The Russians. Right. The buzzards. Thank you.
The Russians.
They're the Russians.
The Libyans.
Right. Exactly. But you know, first there's the layer of that, and then you're right. They hit the storm. They hit, you know, the guys in the canyon, and they have their own, you know, ecosystem and their own level. And it's each time it's a different thing. And you've got the bullet farmers guys, and you've got the people eaters guys.
Oh, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about
different,
that.
Yeah, it is different levels. You know, they get to the green place. They encounter different groups and different challenges.
I hadn't thought about that either, actually. It really is just a series of... And the thing is...
Trials.
They escalate visually and danger-wise, but it really is just a series of interstitial obstacles they have to cover. My storytelling, one of my storytelling guys, John Ammerman, you guys know him from Emory University. He told me once, he goes, the plot of every Three Stooges episode is the same. They have to get up the stairs, and that's it. And then sometimes it's really hard to get up the stairs. And it's just different ways that it's hard to get up the stairs. It's the plot of every Three Stooges. And in a way, like, that's the plot of Mad Max, too. It's like he has to get from point A to point B, and there's a lot of stairs in the way he's gotta go through. But the way that they're segmented and tied together really does feel like a series of concentric circles or something.
Yeah, with each with its own feel and its own topography and everything.
Have you guys talked about Mad Max in relation or in comparison to the Warriors?
We haven't.
No,
but we should.
But as soon as you said that, I went, yes!
Yeah, right.
That
is the exactly, individual groups are so equivalent.
The Warriors, I mean, they're like, everyone travels from their gang's locations in New York. They all gather together.
Sure. Yep.
The Warriors are blamed for the murder of Cyrus.
Warriors.
And then they travel back. Man. There's like the Gnosis like trying to get back home, and then they just they find these like very well defined groups that they have to fight. They have to like get through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the baseball
you nailed it.
It
had to have been mentioned in the creative process with Mad Max.
Baseball Furies. You know, a lot of these groups, which you know, in reviewing the movie in recent years, I wish I could still be as afraid of them as I was the first time.
That doesn't
always hold up. But
rollerblades don't scare you, Yuri.
I haven't seen the movie in ages, but you just reminded me of, speaking of the Nostos thing with Odysseus. So we just met Ulysses, or Odysseus, whatever you want to call him. Dante calls him Ulysses because he's Italian. But the idea of Furiosa as, because I think she's definitely Dante, and Max is Virgil, I think, if we're going to go down that with that paradigm, because he's kind of her guide in a way, and he also leaves at the end. She's on her own journey. He's just kind of there to help, I feel like. And when he realizes that he's done his job, he kind of gets the fuck out of there because he has to, because what's going to happen to them when they get leveled up to wherever Corpus Colossus is or whatever at the very end of the movie? Like, what happens 5 minutes after the movie ends, you know? Is it a happy ending? I don't think it... I mean, it's probably going to be a whole shit show, I would imagine.
It's not going to end well.
And you said before in previous episodes, you know, Max has been in this movie before, literally. I mean, he knows how the movie ends. He's going to get out of there before everything hits the fan. But we also need to talk about Furiosa in terms of centripetal versus centrifugal myths. Like, for example, best example I can think of is Aeneas versus Odysseus. So Trojan War happens. Troy gets sacked hard. Odysseus is trying to get back home. Aeneas doesn't have a home anymore. He has to go centrifugally out to form a new home. So this is where it gets a little bit dicey, or nuanced, I guess, depending on your reading of it. She is striking out. She says, we're heading east. That's all she says. And you find out later that she's also trying to return somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then she finds out that it's not there. So it's at a glance in the beginning of the movie, she looks like an Aeneas figure. She has nowhere to go. She's fleeing. She's running out, trying to find a new home someplace else. Then you find out that she's actually trying to get home, that she's been away this whole time, trying to get back to the Green Place. Then Green Place isn't even there anymore. And all of a sudden it's this boomerang effect where you realize, okay, now we have to go back.
Jack.
Right.
We got to, yeah, it's like lost.
The pack, Jack.
You know what's really interesting about that, man? This is a new thought for me too, R.E. Mad Max, is that it's rare to have a film where I don't know as an audience member what I'm rooting for the main character.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
I know for Furiosa, we want her to get there. She's got a very clear mission. Get these women and herself to the Green Place, to safety and you know, comfort and security.
But we didn't even find out about that until like the second act, right?
Totally right.
Yeah.
It comes late, but we have some sense of like there's a mission and she's trying to complete a mission.
Right.
For Max, even if he finds that Green Place with him, that won't make him happy. We know that. So the titular character of the film, we never know what to root for him. Like, we don't have a clear direction.
Right, the only thing he sort of gives us the only place to hang our hat in that respect is survival. All we want him to do is survive. I mean, that's all he really gives us.
And what a shitty goal.
And that's horrible.
But wait, I mean, do you not think that some sort of sense of home would... I mean, like, in the beginning of the movie,
what does that look like for him, though?
You see the flashbacks of, like, his previous life?
Yeah, right. but I guess that's fair. But I don't know what that looks like for him. I don't believe, even watching the film, that if he got to the Green Place with these people and was offered a home, that he would take it.
Yeah, okay.
And in fact, at the end, he doesn't take it.
He's the true wandering hero. So he is an Aeneas figure for sure. He has nowhere to go. But
doesn't want it also.
No, he doesn't want it.
It's a weird structural narrative for a protagonist. I mean, arguable
protagonist.
He's the red herring protagonist, right? I mean, you think that's right. a movie called Mad Max with a big movie star playing Mad Max. He's been the star of every other movie. Furiosa's kind of like, he's an Aeneas figure. He's the wandering hero. She's the hero with a quest, if we're getting into Joseph Campbell talk. But she's the questing hero masquerading as the wandering hero, because for the first third of the movie, we have no idea what's even happening. We just know that she's got to get away, and he's got to get away. He's just trying to get... These are the people that are going to get him, deliver him from bondage, basically, because he's going to be a slave if they ever catch him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And we haven't even really touched on, I'm sure it was, coming up eventually, that Nux, his journey in this is the...
Oh, I love Nux.
Nux is everybody's favorite character because he's got that journey from the clear journey, the clear change of character from religious zealot to free thinking man, religious war seeking zealot to love and peace seeking finding some peace guy. Which is exciting, and it's funny now that we talk about in terms of Dante, and we're throwing around a lot of Italian and Latin based words. So much of the language in and the nomenclature in Fury Road is from that. I know we've got a lot of sort of Norse Viking mythology to go through, but everybody is an imperator. Nux is a Latin word, word for nut or seed.
I didn't know that. I was thinking of Nox.
Furiosa is also. I mean, that's the Furies and it's
Corpus
all
Colossus,
of a sudden it's coming clear in a way that I didn't see before.
Yeah, that's true for sure. It's a nice borrowing. It's a nice kind of hodgepodge of different mythological backgrounds for sure. But Nux definitely has the most clearly defined character arc, I would say. I mean, you could say Max, he softens up a little bit, or he tells her his name because he wants to kind of have an identity on some level, or to be able to trust somebody with that. But whereas Furiosa just wants what she wants from beginning to end, more or less.
Right.
But I don't know where Nux would fall in that paradigm. Dave, what do you think?
Here's a question for you guys, as the experts on Dante. I'll direct this towards Dave.
Okay.
Is there a major emotional shift or arc that Dante goes through in the process of the Divine Comedy?
Well,
it's not a gotcha question. I'm just kidding.
No. I mean, so it's tough for me to answer that because I've only read the first, the first part of the book. I've only really read Inferno. I would say no, just because I hate it. But, you see him changing. You see him becoming more brave at times and being able to handle the situation that he has been thrown into.
Sure.
I would assume that there's going to be some sort of character growth for him. I don't know. For me...
Is that true, Paul?
Well, it's tricky here because it's autobiographical, so we always have to distinguish between Dante the poet and Dante the pilgrim. So, and David's great at reminding me... I'll say oh, look, Virgil just gave him a big hug and called him son. And he's like, no, Dante wrote Virgil. Virgil's been long dead. Dante, the poet, made his hero hug him in this moment.
Yeah,
He's the author.
I don't really care about the distinction between the poet and the character in the book. To me, I still feel like a lot of this book was just written as my neighbor borrowed my thing and he didn't give it back, so fuck him. I'm gonna write this book about how he's in hell. It feels like a very spiteful, resentful...
Oh, totally.
He's like a very small, petty man. Dante Poet.
Dante Poet, yeah. If we're distinguishing, yeah.
He's a small, petty asshole, so...
It's wish fulfillment. Wish fulfillment.
It is all wish fulfillment, yeah.
But
yeah.
With... One thing, when I first saw Fury Road, the things that hit me were, on leaving the theater were, I need a tetanus shot now. And then I was really... the transition, the way that the colors are used in that movie, mm-hmm. which is absolutely incredible, because you've got the, like this, the place where they start is like, you know, like rock and brown, and then they hit the storm, which, and like everything is red for like 40 minutes, and then they're going toward the green place. Like, to me, the use of color kind of feels like the transition between levels of hell.
And there's mm-hmm. the blue sequence where it's kind of like mm-hmm. dusk or what?
My favorite.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Kind of like
when they're stuck
like
in the mud.
The dusky midnight.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, the, yeah. It's like the Swamps of Sadness sequence in the movie.
Well, yeah, the swamps are almost kind of like your forest, because the people totally. Have almost turned into trees there.
Yeah, you're
in,
right.
In
wow.
that they're the stilt walkers.
Yeah, I forgot about that. What's going on with those guys?
I mean, just visually. Well, we had it explained to us. Those were the rest of the Vivalini. Who stayed behind, but were, you know,
oh,
left in
God.
A frozen place.
Yeah, because that's the green place, right? I forgot about that, because they say, yeah. oh, you must have passed through it and you didn't realize.
Yeah, those are the women who stayed behind.
You know, in talking about, I love approaching this from this, if only to give me a different eye on something that we've been looking at for so long. There is so much about high and low and going from low to high in Fury Road, and it seems like also climbing, you know, out of hell. There's a lot of that... a lot of those kind of visuals throughout the film, even from the beginning when he breaks free from the war boys and runs through and is in the water and he's leaping up and he's trying to get, you know, he's grasping at the sky, you know, for first he sees the sky and then he breaks through and it's low to high and, you know, him coming out of, you know, after the storm, you know, being buried and rising out of that. And,
yeah.
you know, even, the polecat's giving a different level to what, I mean, you know, I could easily just be reaching at stuff like this, but and the more I think of it, there's a lot of sort of low to high visuals and climbing out of the depths of something.
See, I hadn't thought about that, because when I was thinking about it, I mean, that's a really good point, and I think of it as being almost unremittingly horizontal, because so much of it is this chase sequence.
Yeah.
Where mm-hmm. they're just heading, I mean, we're heading east, and that's kind of like the synopsis of the, you know, the first 7/8 of the movie, where they're just they're going east by hook or by crook. They gotta get where they're going. And there's another time. And then I feel like at the very end they ascend, and they get to go up
right.
to mm-hmm. they get to go up
yeah,
to
right.
what would be the top of Mount Purgatory. In which in Dante's world, it sounds like a theme park. That's not what I mean. They have
the worst attendant.
If you read the Jerry Pournelle Larry Niven Dante, he thinks as he's going through it, he doesn't believe that he's actually in hell. The protagonist, Dante's character, is a science fiction writer who he's done something stupid to impress his fans at a convention and died and is in hell. But he thinks he won't allow himself to believe he's in hell because he's a pragmatist. And he thinks that it's some sort of theme, some hell design theme park.
That's so funny. I think there's a thing that David and I really need to watch. Is it Dylan McDermott? I forget who it is. It's or the other guy.
Dylan?
Yeah, exactly.
Dermot Mulroney.
Yeah, maybe it's him. Anyway, there's this all-star list of people doing voiceover for this thing where it was Marcus Cirque? I should know this. Anyway, there's an animated Dante movie that it's basically just set in modern-day New York, I guess, and it's all done with paper cutouts, I think. Or it's this really, this really interesting...
I would
really
pay $100 to see that movie right now.
It's
the
amazing.
Way you describe
it. When this episode airs, I'll put the link
really
up for it.
He pays a lot of money for things.
for things that
I think
he
you can rent it on Amazon for something. You can rent it on Vimeo or something for like $4, and it looks incredible. And it's got like
that's
Martha
cool.
Plimpton does a bunch of voice to it.
Ooh.
There's a like all star cast of like a who's who in terms of who's doing the voiceover stuff, and it's really smart in terms of how they update it to modern times. But he's the same way. He doesn't really realize that he doesn't acknowledge that he's there. I think, feel like a lot of us, I don't want to get, I don't know, self-helpy or whatever, but I feel like a lot of people are in hell without realizing it.
Oh, yeah.
If you're if we're talking about, like, addiction or, you know, it's...
Other people.
I mean, the first step
in
it...
You guys ever thought about that?
drop that on you.
This feels like a guy heavy all of a sudden, you guys. I don't know. I need to question
you
some
you want a very special
choices.
Episode? You're going to get a very special episode, goddammit.
You'll need therapy afterwards episode.
Yeah. Let's walk this back to something less heavy. So Adam and Eve get expelled from Eden.
Yeah, less heavy.
but
they have
man.
To go east of Eden. They're going...
Yeah,
I mean,
let's go
is
somewhere
heading...
less heavy, the fall of man. Go on.
Yeah,
man.
Exactly. So they get expelled from Eden, and they have to head west. David had to turn away from the microphone. His life is over. so this shit, they get expelled, and where do they go? East of Eden. They have to go east. It's
east
kind
of Eden.
An anti heliotropic thing. Like the heliotropic thing is like man is supposed to go west as he gets older. You're
the sunset.
Sure. Yeah, the sunset, and she's going against that. And then she realizes when she gets as far east as she can go, well, no, now you have to kind of course correct and go back.
Wow. That's good.
That's actually really interesting.
You know what? You know, we're going to high five you over here.
we
just high fived you across the United States.
Yeah, there's probably a little delay on that high five.
Yeah, that's our slate. That's our de facto mid episode slate.
I mean, I don't know what that means as far as, I mean, just acknowledging that she's going in the direction of the sun.
I can unpack that a little bit, I think.
Please.
If we tease that metaphor, I think that it's blind optimism and hope that's unjustified for her, that she's this youthful exuberance of just get back to where I was when I was four years old.
She's trying to go back in time.
She's literally chasing her youth, exactly.
And you can, as they say, you can never go home, and she...
And
can't.
She realizes that. And then when she has that moment of like, oh, what I knew as a child is gone, that was chasing a youth that doesn't exist anymore, she stops, grows the fuck up, and then heads back west to go to her real home. I mean,
well,
I think
she keeps it. At first, she doesn't. She's like, oh, it's not here anymore.
Right.
I guess I should keep heading east. Maybe I haven't gone far enough. She needs Max to turn her around, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moment where she should decide, and she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he follows them, catches up with them, and then points at a map, pointing to her what has literally been her home for most of her life, and he says that what is it? That's your best chance at hope, maybe redemption. You know, those are the. I mean, there's only one other moment in the movie where those big words are used. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
well, that's a very good little metaphor there. I hadn't thought about it in those terms.
So you're right.
It must be intentional, just because the directions are so. Hammered in the script and in the film. We always know where they're... And to be fair, it just makes sense logistically. Head west, head east, head west. Like, you can track it from the sun, so I get it on a storytelling perspective. But also on a metaphor perspective, it feels like in 14 years of developing a script, you don't not talk about that in terms of metaphor.
Yeah.
It has to come
up. It probably came up at some point, yeah. I mean, it's also... I mean, if you think 9 days of falling through heaven was long for Lucifer, I mean, imagine 160 days, they say, right? Of nothing but salt.
Yeah, I don't buy that they have enough gas for it, but...
Yeah, I feel the same way.
You tapped into a vein here, Paul. You got to be careful. Like, nothing's ever aggravated Yuri more in the history of our friendship than this number. He literally, he gets agitated, his fists clench, and he really, really can't stand it.
Hang on, though. Maybe since they're tapping into Greek mythology and they're tapping into you know, the Norse stuff, maybe it's also... Oh, I never thought about this. Maybe it's... Like 40 days and 40 nights in the Old Testament. Maybe it's just like a long fucking
time. A long time.
You know? 160 is 40 times 4.
But if they had said 40 days.
If that was at 40, I would have been into it, because that just means a long time. And I sort of realized
that. Maybe that expression is just morphed. I mean, over time, we don't know what year this is, really, right? I mean, so maybe that's just the new expression of saying just a really long time, 160 days worth. And they're like, it's just used figuratively, maybe. I'm trying to rescue Miller from this. Because I agree, that's a long fucking time to drive on that amount of gas.
Do you guys think that that's possible? Let's just take a second. Do you guys think it's possible that they could drive 160 days straight through with those motorcycles and carrying no water?
you just slid that in.
Sweeten the pot, yeah.
The water thing, I mean, yeah, the water thing is definitely more damning than the gasoline, because we don't know. I mean, they could have found some sort of alternative fuel source, maybe?
I don't know. It seems
gasoline.
Like gas. I think gasoline might be the only game in town, though, because I don't know if they have. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Oh, guzzling. Travis, you still hate the word guzzling as much as you?
I do hate it.
It's a pretty bad word.
Yeah, I hate it. You know, listen, the more the film goes on, the more I am less bothered by the mix of highbrow and lowbrow language. Like, I understand that's the world we live in, where there's a collusion and collision of different linguistic sort of styles coming together to make a new thing. And some of those words are going to suck, and some of those words are going to be cool. And so guzzling happens to bug me from the get-go, because it just feels lame. It just feels lame to me.
Let me talk to you about... I want to come back to... I lose all track of time when we're doing these things, so just let me know if we're running short. But...
I'm keeping an eye on it. We're good.
All right, cool. Speaking of words, I want to get to a word that's super cool... But that's confusing to me. Mediocre.
Love that word. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about
mediocre, as far as I understand, and your understanding of this, is the worst insult possible, right?
Right.
Yes.
And it's used when Nux says, I got this, Immortan Joe. I'm going to go get her right now. And he jumps onto the truck and immediately just fucks up. And he falls off and he said, and Immortan Joe says, mediocre. And it's such a burn.
Yeah. Sweet burn.
But earlier, oh man, what's his name? Morsov. No, when Morsov, when he has that moment where he's shot through the face with an arrow and they're like, come on, man, do the thing. And then he sprays the chrome and he goes double bombing, like double spear bombing this the buzzard.
Yeah.
And they go, mediocre Morsov. He just died in the most badass heroic way possible that they all want to die, but they say mediocre Morsov.
Is that right?
I watched it last night. Huh, I wrote it down.
What?
Well, then we need to rethink it. Wait, I think
that's
the first that I'm hearing that.
Yeah.
It seems like the best thing possible. Is it possible somebody would... I can only think that somebody would be saying it sarcastically, but why, this guy, your friend, your fellow war boy in arms...
not a sarcastic moment at all.
They would not say that,
I don't think. We'll have to revisit that. We may do a special addendum to this episode or next episode while we sort that out. Because
I made an actual Mad Max point. This is awesome.
You made a thing.
I did a thing.
I mean, we may have to rethink our conception of that word. I've always loved it just because I often think that about the world, that... I try to tell my little sister and my friends that the best thing you can be is weird, and the worst thing you can be is nothing.
It's
and
boring,
I think that mediocre is, you know, I even talked about this on our other podcast yesterday, that sometimes I want a film to either be better or worse. I don't care which, because it's still good to me if it's better or worse. But if it's just mediocre, it's instantly forgettable and shitty.
Just
what's
commit,
the most,
yeah.
What's the most mediocre film you can think of?
Hold on. Teen Wolf is the one we just did.
Oh, yeah.
Teen
I listened to you guys talk about that.
Teen Wolf is fucking mediocre, man. It's not good
enough. Well,
you saw
a lot of untapped potential there, right?
Yeah, there's just a lot of untapped potential. If that movie's better or worse, it's great. It's just kind of like, okay, you kind of did a thing for a little bit. Yeah, and...
It's, you know what it's like? I'm sorry, go ahead, Yuri.
No, I was just going to say, what's the movie with Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts and they ride on a scooter? And like, literally, that's all I can remember about the film. I remember walking out of the film thinking... that nothing happened in that film, and I immediately forgot it.
Is that the one where Tom Hanks is like learning?
Goes to college
English
or something?
Second language teacher or something?
Or he goes to college.
This is the worst.
I don't know. This
pitch
is
in movie
this
history.
Is,
this
right.
sounds terrible.
Yeah.
What the fuck was that?
Yeah, I see.
All
exactly.
Right, I'm gonna go.
I don't know.
Rapid fire, real quick. I'm going to give you three examples of what I think Travis is talking about. Okay. I'm going to talk about the Book of Revelation, where he says. I would that you had been, because you were lukewarm, I am going to fuck you up right now, because I would that you had rather been hot or cold, but you were lukewarm, and so you're about to get yours.
Yes.
Okay, relatable reference. Yeah. Everyone has read the Book of Revelation.
Book of Revelation.
Nailed it.
Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, where he says he's not as recently horribly misquoted by your boy Dabo Swinney from Clemson or whatever.
Guy.
Yeah. Because he's kind of heard of who Martin Luther King is, I guess, that one time.
that one time,
thanks for the day off every year.
He says in this letter, he has less of a problem with the white supremacists than he does with these just suburban white guys who just the white middle class who just are too concerned with their white picket fence to get involved and commit to a stance because they're just afraid of the whole thing. He says, at least the white supremacists, I know where they stand. Mm-hmm. They fucking hate me, mm-hmm. but I get that. These guys won't you know, get off. They're just trying to sit on the fence here in a time when you really can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Last example is from The Wire, 40 Degree Day. Remember Stringer Bell?
I
saying you guys are giving me a bunch of 40 Degree Days out here. Like nobody gives a shit about a 40 Degree Day. 50,
that's cold as hell.
Right.
When you're saying 50, or maybe it's a 50. The thing is, 50 Degree Days is people will be out barbecuing. 30 Degree Day, everybody's talking about how cold it is. 40 Degrees, nobody ever talks about it because it's like right in the middle there, I think.
Did you know that's kind of similar to that, I guess. The reason why, like, the Weather Channel... and other for-profit weather forecasters will rarely ever say there's a 50% chance of rain.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mediocre.
Because, yeah, of course, there's a 50% chance of rain. That just means, like, I have no idea.
Right.
We were just talking about this the other day.
Like, a 60% chance of rain means it's probably going to rain. Like, it probably won't.
We were talking about this the other day in terms of you ask somebody a question and they go, I don't know, maybe. Like, well, I knew maybe before I asked you. Yeah. We're back where we started.
Right.
Yeah.
Anything's possible.
I'm really wrestling with this idea that we've blown this interpretation of mediocre because it feels so intuitively true to me. It just, the second I understood it or heard it the way I thought I heard it, at least, I was like, yes, that's my experience with the world too, that the worst thing you can be is mediocre. You must be terrible or you must be brilliant, but to be mediocre
commit,
is the worst.
It, yeah.
But now I feel like if we've misheard this early thing, which we'll have to go back and
listen to. I don't think we have.
To,
we have to go back and see what he's... We have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, I mean, what are
the
interesting
things? You know the scene I'm talking about, right? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty early on.
Sure.
They're fighting off the
buzzards.
You're like the
yeah,
first...
It's where the film really fucking came alive for me. I mean...
But is this one of those things where I horribly mishear something and people think I'm a racist homophobe, or is it something you actually heard?
Oh, when she says "fang it,"
yes, exactly.
I was dying laughing when I heard you guys talk about that.
Kyle, Dave, do you know what happened? Let's not get back into it. I was very embarrassed, and I also thought at one point someone called someone else a raghead. It's just fucking. I can't get this Aussie slang right, and it's to my eternal chagrin.
Oh, so good. Because I heard, it was like a car crash. I mean, just listening to you talk about that, Travis, because I was like, I know what he's thinking. Because I watched the movie with the subtitles on.
That's
I watch everything
fair.
With subtitles on.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let's just talk about this for a second then. Because if you close your eyes and listen to that, what else could it fucking be if you don't speak Australian?
That's... Also, wait, who's providing the... did you watch, like, DVD of this, or...
I watched the DVD,
so
yeah.
You
okay,
watched the DVD? So is that where you came up with this mediocre thing that you're saying that you, you just... Is it, was it from the subtitles or from the from listening?
It's in the subtitles, and like he clearly says it too. I mean, if you, I don't want to harp on it, but if you listen to it, I watched everything with actually since I watched The Wire. I'm from Baltimore, but I still had a hard time making up.
Well,
some
maybe,
of it.
Maybe Morton Joe's just a dick.
Wait
a minute. I have a theory.
Go.
Without going back to.
Oh yeah, maybe he's being sarcastic. Yeah.
No,
I mean I don't know. Like he's. This guy like does this badass thing and he's like says mediocre.
I mean, no,
in that reading, mediocre would be the highest compliment, and they're being sincere when they say it to Morsov when he dies valiantly. But then, Morton Joe would be saying, "Yeah, real mediocre, buddy.
Well,
this was your shot."
Do they say? See, I didn't even know his name was Morsov. Do they say leading up to it mediocre, or do they say it after he's done it?
He does it, and then there's a huge... I'm almost positive I'm remembering this right, because I just watched it last night, literally. He does it, and Max is in the car right next to him. There's a huge explosion scene. You see all this red debris flying by Max, and then you hear somebody go, "Mediocre Morsov." It's M-O-R-S-O-V, Morsov.
Okay.
Mediocre Morsov, they say, as they're all cheering.
Interesting.
Very confused right now.
In celebration of
because
this kamikaze act he just did.
As he's trying to, like... With the thing in his face and he's trying to get up, I can see them saying it to goad him on, like mediocre, you know, to get him to do it. But afterwards,
It's after. You
really wrecked our heads.
We don't have to spend a ton of time.
No,
on
that's
this,
important
but,
to us.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to hear what you guys
say. We've spent probably a total of 2 hours on the word mediocre in the last. So this is a drop in a bucket as far as we're concerned.
Well, etymologically, I looked it up in my old school 1960s dictionary. It comes from medi plus ocris in Latin, and it just means neither good nor very bad.
I was wondering if it was some sort of portmanteau that had just been the meaning had just been kind of mangled.
I don't like that
between the present day.
Yeah, maybe and, I don't like that. That's if that's the case, I don't like it as well. Also, I want to blaze past this thing that you said, Paul, that feels relevant to me. Did you say ever since The Wire you watch everything with subtitles on?
I did indeed, yes. And I don't want to. I mean, I'm from Baltimore. I don't have a problem with the Baltimore accent, but. That was a terrible Baltimore accent.
It sounded like you had a stroke.
Right, you got the Balmer. You got the Balmer part right.
Hang on, guys. We'll be right back.
Do you smell burning
toast? I've got to take this toast out of the oven.
Exactly. No, yeah. Ever since The Wire, I mean, I feel like I'm really ruining my street cred here for whatever I have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally
had some.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just steeped in it. I just have it in spades. I have despair. Oh, wait, I want to tell you guys something about something else that came up, because you guys are, like, not allowed to Google stuff, right?
Not during the show.
Correct, yeah. Also, we don't do that.
Right, because we're lazy. We forget.
You just forget. The guy who played... So, in Road Warrior, the guy who is basically Mad Max's slave, and then he's the pilot, right? The auto-gyro pilot or whatever. And then he ends up being his buddy at the end. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of Thunderdome... Mm-hmm. This is what happened. We were talking about this for a while, about how they just don't remember each other.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is going on here? It's obviously the same actor. He's also a pilot. I looked this up around the time, and the guy's name is Bruce Spence.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the actor, yep.
And the quote from this is, he was Jebediah the pilot in the Bartertown movie, whatever, Thunderdome. He had previously played Gyro Captain in Mad Max 2, Road Warrior. The quote is, they were well into the shoot when they offered me a part described as, quote, not the gyro captain, but kind of like the gyro captain, exclamation
point. And the quote goes, a drug-filled email. Or letter.
Isn't that crazy? They said there's some kind of a reflection of him and that they were having difficulty casting the role, so they thought to themselves, why not Bruce?
That is insane. That
so
is
confusing.
So insane.
Just make him the same guy.
It's clearly the same fucking character.
Exactly.
What the fuck are you talking about?
They even draw a parallel to the woman that he leaves with.
He's got a kid now.
Now he's got a kid who could have obviously been from that woman.
Obviously.
Totally. It's so unnecessarily confusing.
Oh, yeah. God damn it. Sometimes, and that's what drives me crazy. Listen, thank you anyone who tweets at us and sort of gives us links. I do watch all the ones that you guys send over. But in a way, like the need to go through the chronology and the characters of some of these things, they're clearly not thought out. Like that, the thing about it is, George Miller doesn't fucking know what movie comes where. He doesn't know. Like, he doesn't think about it that way. He thinks about it as like mythic structure storytelling. And just tales and legends. That's how he thinks about it. He's not like, well, we got to seed this here because then this will tie in. Logistics don't interest him as much, I think, across films. Now, within films, they certainly do. But that story just dramatically indicates to me that that dude doesn't give a shit. Like, that's a crazy fucking thing.
I'd give him a pass, too, because, I mean, Byron Kennedy? Someone close to him had just passed away scouting locations, right? So I'm sure he was... Not to say that he's not accountable at all, but I mean, I'm sure that he was going through his own thing at the time, and maybe little details like that may have fallen. The casting issues probably weren't his top priority.
Sure, he was clearly dealing with a lot of different things.
You can have not a priority, but also just make sense. I think that's not asking too much as an audience, and that decision, let's be honest, doesn't make sense.
Yeah. No, it doesn't.
Am I being rude?
It's just weird. I mean, but it was something I've always wanted to...
I appreciate that, because that blew my head off a little bit. There's been a lot of things to sort of take away from this in terms of, like, things, research we have to do now, or, like, things we have to rewatch. So that's exciting to me.
Yeah, right?
I mean, listen, the subtitle of this podcast is basically Yuri and Travis Get It Wrong.
Yuri
and Travis. And they're yelled at by the internet. So
here's a question for you. I didn't mean to jump on your line. The very first thing that I just thought about this last night, when he says... As he's getting captured, he says, I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead. I'm thinking about this in terms of Dante. Mm-hmm. Dante is at times literally running from the dead in Inferno, where he's being chased. Mm-hmm. Hunted by scavengers, totally happens. I mean, even the war boys in the chase sequence in the beginning of the movie, they look like infernal ghouls, basically. Yeah. They're pasty white. Right. They've got their head shaved. They're almost like... what's the guy from Lord of the Rings?
Precious Smeagol. Gollum.
Yeah, they're kind
Smeagol.
Of... Yeah.
He's also running from the dead as in the sense that he's running from his past. Yep.
Exactly. But Dante, I mean, he says hunted by scavengers, and there's a nice linguistic thing. Haunted by those I could not protect. Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, Beatrice is dead. He couldn't do anything to save her from being dead. And now she's literally asking him to come have, like, a talking to in heaven. She needs to
And
have
we've
a
kind of covered this already a little bit, but he basically is living there. He gets captured, taken underground to somewhere there's no sunlight. It's fiery hellhole. Where it's just surrounded by basically ghosts down there underground. So I think that's not far off, honestly.
Here's another mythological tie-in.
Is he afraid of them?
Max isn't afraid of shit, bro.
It's true. He's resigned.
I guess that's why when he's in there, he says, I'm afraid of
them. Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Do you remember when Ernie Hudson comes out? It's so fucking rad.
classic Mad Max.
How long do you think Rick Moranis will last?
In the wasteland.
Wait, when he's possessed or normal Rick Moranis? Because when he's the fucking key master.
When he's the key master, you know he'll last.
Lewis doesn't stand a chance.
No. Lewis is screwed.
Old Sluis.
Unless there's some accounting to do. Unless, you know, he and the people eater would get along. Right.
If it happens to people who are for drinks, it's just not fun.
Hey, groovy party, right?
So Vulcan, or Hephaestus in Greek mythology, the guy who makes everybody's armor, basically, he's limp, he's lame. So
I agree.
He's limp, he's lame, he can't be tamed. Hephaestus. His smithy is under a mountain. I think it's called Mount Hephaestus, or I forget what it's called. I'm so embarrassed to be doing it. You're so ashamed of me right now, David. He just said, that's Hephaestus. But no, it's underneath a mountain, and it's a smithy. I mean, if you look at that opening scene where he's being tattooed, he's being branded, literally, he's about to get branded, and that's where he draws the line. He's like, all right, I'm just going to fuck all these guys up. But, I mean, he kind of, I feel like...
The organic mechanic is Vulcan.
Organic mechanic, exactly. He is the Hephaestus in this thing. Like, he's under a mountain. He's just... he's their guy. He's like the thing that kind of makes everything mm-hmm. work.
That's.
But I'm also confused about.
No, go ahead.
I'm confused about how they keep. What's going on with that water? Is it a giant well
that
he found?
Yeah.
That he's tapped.
It's the aquifer in the middle of the desert from Beyond Thunderdome.
Well.
Aquifer, yeah, like this.
Not that you put on a baby's butt, not aquifer, but aquifer.
Yeah. Mary and I disagree about that.
What's aquifer? Drinking.
Aquacola. So well, according to the comic book, I can quote because I've not read it. Someone else held that stronghold prior to Immortan Joe, and Immortan Joe led a basically conquest of the mountain and took over this aquifer. And to create his kingdom, basically.
Okay.
So he led the peep leader and the bullet farmer and all these guys and his men to go take over this mountain. They had to climb it and sort of. So he's conquered this land.
Also.
And speaking of, I'm sorry.
No, keep on that roll because I'll come back with this.
In terms of conquest, on a kind of yes and on that one, this improv lingo, Travis.
Yeah, you nailed it.
I first met Travis in an improv troupe. I wasn't in it. I was watching it. quietly. So they go in terms of imperial narratives, right? So like this is basically what happened with the Roman Empire, isn't it? I mean, they kind of spread themselves too thin. They're off dicking around in England, and all of a sudden it's like, oh God, we're weak at our base. We got to go back and keep the home fires burning, which is exactly what happens in this case. Where they realize we can't go back there. Are you crazy? And they realize, oh no, they've like pulled the goalies ostensibly. Yeah. Nobody's home. All these war boys are dead. There's been this huge attrition rate. In the day or two or whatever that they've traveled. So, yeah, like, there's nobody home. We can just go and take over.
Yeah,
we'll
Winterfell is not
we'll
defended. There you go.
Well yeah. put, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, guys. Thank
Another
you, guys.
Mythological
Thank you guys.
I forget. I forget.
We'll talk about
when I say
class.
I forget, it's because I've already admitted to not having actually read Dante's Inferno. But during the journey, do they encounter... In the different circles of hell, is there a leader of each one? Are there different demons that reign over those areas?
There are people who are kind of like workers in mm-hmm. hell who are overseeing the specific tortures.
Those are kind of like representatives, right? I mean, he'll meet one person who kind of represents the whole like lollipop.
Right. Well, because I wonder if we could draw lines back to the people eater, the bullet farmer, Immortan Joe, the leader of the rock riders, and all those as sort of I don't know. Once again, stretching.
I don't know if they're not necessarily leaders.
Representatives.
Right, there is kind of a staff. Like in some places, it's just like the punishment is just well. The
you
punishment is just
these centaurs. All day.
Yeah, centaur. Awesome. There's a place where there's a river of blood. There's a river of blood that you can barely get your head out of, and when you do poke your head out to breathe, a centaur shoots
an
arrow.
Oh, that sounds so shitty.
But here's the cool thing about in terms of that
sick analysis.
There aren't really bosses like in a video game. Although I do feel like watching Mad Max last night, it transitions so well. It's almost like it's just so well choreographed, and it does kind of feel like a video game. It's like, okay, the buzzards, that's like Glass Joe or whatever, like Punch-Out, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out.
Right.
1985.
Sweet spot
but
for you.
It's like, okay, you beat them, okay, now it's time for the next guy. Like, you gotta just keep beating until they finally beat Immortan Joe, and he's the main boss, and it's like you kind of beat the game at that point, you know?
Immortan Joe is the guy from the Warriors with the bottles.
Right.
Wait, so Immortan Joe is David Patrick Kelly?
Good pull.
Yeah.
Good pull.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
or
the
Mike
War
Tyson.
Boys are the Gramercy Riffs. okay.
But how do they kill Immortan Joe? They just rip his mask off.
Yeah,
it's like his lower jaw comes off. Although it is a little bit unclear. You know, it's as far as one of those we talk about how everything is so clear. That is a bit left open to interpretation
Which
in the way that it's presented.
I really like that.
Yeah. It's such
a
big moment,
a god.
Too.
You don't want clarity on that. I do think that that's a smart decision.
Oh, okay.
I think it's actually less ambiguous than I would like, in a way. I like the idea. We haven't gotten to this in our four-minute sequences yet, but I remember from years ago watching the film. But the ambiguity of killing a deity really appeals to me on a storytelling level. So... Mm-hmm. I don't mind that.
Interesting. Yeah, and it's almost like they cut around it almost.
Yeah.
Like they and it's suggested in such a way that the same way in Greek tragedy, it's more effective if you don't see the killing. If all the violence has to happen off stage for practical reasons and for kind of philosophical reasons, same thing, like in was it Diary of Anne Frank, where the guy comes over with bad news and says,
"Wow, that was a cool reference."
The guy comes over with really bad news, and Otto, her dad, he says, "Don't you want to tell the kids to like go upstairs? This is really bad." And he says, "No, I promise you, whatever they imagine will be 10 times worse than whatever the worst thing you can possibly say."
Do you guys want to do an episode where we compare Anne Frank to Mad Max?
Yes.
Well, I think we need a new point of comparison. So Matt, like Anne Frank to
Star Wars. We can totally do that.
Force Awakens.
Well, I mean, they both had a lot of hiding scenes, so that's something we'd start with.
Oh, right.
And they were both tragedies.
Both tragedies, absolutely, on a tragic scale. Listen, that's going to go off the rails. We're about an hour in here, so I think maybe we put a pin in this conversation. Yuri, how do you feel?
Yeah, I was thrilled by how many things we came up with.
Yeah, Paul, that's some good stuff, man. Good researching.
You too, David.
David, no.
Hey, I have a bunch of stuff about Joseph Campbell.
I wanted to get in. We're going to get into that.
Well, you said David has...
And then we never got to it.
Yeah,
let's
Campbell,
take a second on that.
And then, like, you
No, that's actually right.
Oh, I thought you said you didn't want to talk about it.
I was like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, let's take a second on that. That's actually worth...
It's too late,
guys.
Let's
get
into
Campbell.
Don't you sack me, David Fountain.
He's going to beat the shit out of me after... As soon as this episode's over, Dave's going to kick my ass.
The problem with this podcast is that by the... Or Paul and I's podcast... is that at some point I'm definitely going to murder him and we will be recording. So, like, I can't pretend like I didn't
do it.
That's great.
Well, you don't have to air it, though. You don't have to air it. That's up to you. Because you'll be the living one left.
They'll take my computer, though.
Well, just delete the file.
That'll be your punishment, though, because you'll have to complete the podcast on your own.
Maybe we should just invite David and not Paul onto one day to talk about Joseph Campbell.
Oh, slam.
Oh, man.
Oh, shit.
Wow, all right, I deserve that. I didn't mean to talk. I feel bad now. I feel like I
hogged the mic. To be fair, all three of us did. We started the thread.
Yeah,
but listen, one thing we're good at is starting threads and not finishing them. That's kind of what our podcast does.
Yeah, we're pretty good at that.
We do that. And people out there, I'm going to shout out to our... we're going to plug our own podcast. If you're wondering, do I want to read the Divine Comedy? You should just know that most of what we do is like what we just did here, where we just talk about this.
Yeah.
Right. And...
Dante is kind of an afterthought.
I just
usually
kind of, it's very similar in that I just sit in silence, like glaring at Paul, just like, "What have you done to me?"
Just give.
I had a future one.
Just giving me enough rope to hang
myself.
For
Dave and Paul's listeners, we talk about Mad Max.
Yeah, our shows are.
Yeah, and you guys are pretty good about keeping it on topic.
Good.
Yeah,
they're really good.
They're responsible podcasters.
Hey,
don't
you guys think it was so sick when that guy was playing guitar?
Oh,
super dope!
You know that do for
you? You know what? Classic Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, that's right. He's wearing a separate face.
Yeah,
he's
that's
wearing
part
a separate
of the
face.
Journey.
You guys, he's got a mask on.
Oh shit!
So
there
fuck
you
guys. Nailed it.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, there's so much left to unpack. We'll have to do it another time.
All right, you guys want to do your out, and then we'll do our out, and we'll get out of here.
We'll get out.
Yeah,
then we get out. You're gonna throw her away. I am Paul Cantrell.
I'm David Fountain,
and we'll see you in hell.
My name is Yuri Lowenthal.
My name is Travis Sintel,
and you are awaiting.